Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Have they thought through the fact that the average electric vehicle costs $16,000 more than the internal combustion engine?
Texas Representative Chip Roy.
Have they thought through that if you eliminate every internal combustion engine in America, it would be less than 1% impact on CO2 production? Because China has 1,100 coal-fired plants, America has 250. India and China are spewing out CO2 at increasing rates. We are unilaterally disarming and undermining our own economic strength, well-being, our own economic prosperity, our own energy freedom, all in the false name of pursuing unicorn energy theories by my colleagues on the other side of the aisle that are killing the average American family, killing their budgets, and now on steroids, existential threat. All of these EVs, those supply chains start now.
This is Agriculture Today.
I rise in support of H.R. 1713, the DOE and USDA Interagency Research Act.
Chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, Oklahoma's Frank Lucas.
This bill allows the Department of Energy and the Department of Agriculture to work together to improve how we grow our food, fiber, and fuel in America. As a farmer and rancher myself, I'm proud to sponsor this bill, which will help us address cross-cutting research challenges that will advance crop science, maximize carbon storage, enhance precision agricultural technologies, and more. DOE and USDA already have a successful track record of collaboration to mitigate invasive species, to modernize the grid, address the energy-water nexus, develop biofuels, and improve agricultural operations. DOE has some of the country's most advanced computing capacities, as well as world-class research facilities and a depth of scientific expertise. These resources can be used to support the work being done by America's farmers and ranchers, ultimately strengthening our agricultural production. The bill before us today is smart, bipartisan legislation that codifies the partnership between DOE and USDA, ensuring they can continue to work together on these interdisciplinary challenges. I want to thank my ranking member, Zoe Lofgren, for working with me on this legislation and helping to pass it through the Science Committee with unanimous support. I appreciate her support of agricultural research, and I urge all of my colleagues to join us in supporting this bill.
Ranking member is Zoe Lofgren from California.
I rise in support of this bill. This bipartisan bill introduced by Chairman Lucas and myself authorizes cross-cutting joint research and development between the Department of Energy and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Together, these agencies leverage their incredible capabilities to address some of our multidisciplinary research challenges in crop science, carbon storage, and precision agriculture technologies. Codifying the partnership between these agencies is a testament to our commitment to combat climate change and to serve the agricultural communities like those in my district and throughout the nation. We generated substantial momentum through the Bipartisan CHIPS and Science Act, which included research support towards agricultural productivity improvement goals. This bill will sustain and strengthen this momentum by empowering deeper cooperation between two of our top science agencies, enabling national research and ag capability to fully realize the opportunities presented by new and emerging technologies. The technologies that are being used on farms in my district are really cutting edge. For example, on farms in my district, there is in use a giant machine that roams the field and by computer identifies weeds and zaps them with lasers. This is done automatically, doesn't use any pesticides, and those weeds are permanently gone. It's really an example of how we are entering a high-tech area in precision agriculture. And the federal government can help facilitate progress in this field through bills like the one before us today.
Lucas, also a former chair of the House Ag Committee.
As we've heard, H.R. 1713, the DOE and USDA Interagency Research Act, is smart, bipartisan policy to make it easier to address the agricultural research challenges facing our nation. By passing this bill, we are supporting the science and technology that will enable easier production agriculture.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The USDA's latest farm income forecast report shows a significant drop between 2022 and 2023. Danny Munch, an economist with the American Farm Bureau, says the picture is a little brighter than the August predictions, but not much.
In the August reports, USDA forecasted that farm income from 2022 would drop 23%, a $41 billion drop from 2022. In this new November report, they adjusted that number, $41 billion, to $31.8 billion, which is a 17% drop from 2022. In total, that would give you a total net farm income of $151 billion for 2023 compared to the $141 billion estimated previously in August. The most significant revisions are attributable to lower production expenses compared to what they estimated in August. There's still a $14.9 billion expected increase in what farmers are paying for production expenses, which is about 4%, but that's 7% lower than what they forecasted in the August release. For all categories, except fuels and oils, electricity, and interest expenses, they adjusted their numbers downward. Things like fertilizer, pesticides, seeds, those all saw decreases from what they estimated that farmers would be paying. Electricity, fuels, oils, interest expenses all saw increases. So those are things farmers saw upward adjustments and are going to pay more for.
Chad Smith, Washington.
When choosing cover crops, cereal rye is something producers might consider. K-State weed specialist Sarah Lancaster.
From a weed scientist's perspective, rye is my favorite cover crop. But there's two sides to every coin, right? And so the weed management perspective, the good side to rye is that you can plant it, it establishes fall or spring, grows fast, really hardy, produces lots of biomass, which is what we want to suppress the weeds. But it can also cross-pollinate with wheat. It can be a terrible problem for foreign material in weeds. And from a weed control perspective, the big problem is that there are really very, very limited herbicide options for controlling cereal rye as a weed in a winter wheat crop.
Lancaster says what producers should keep in mind when it comes to hopefully taking care of the issue before it reaches the field.
As we think about managing or controlling cereal rye, the number one thing we need to do is just prevention. Because, again, there really are very limited herbicide options. So, anecdotally, talk to folks who were fairly certain it came from maybe contamination in a dry fertilizer spreader that had previously been used to spread cover crops. So, checking that kind of equipment. If you do use a drill to seed cover crops and wheat, making sure you've got your drill cleaned out well. You know, any point of contamination in the process is going to be so very important for farmers that are trying to manage both of these crops in the fall.
For rye that has already been established in the field, she says what chemicals producers could use.
Chemically, the only real options for us are herbicide-tolerant wheat varieties. So the older of those would be the Clearfield varieties. So there's a handful of those on the market. The herbicide you use in those is Beyond. And I think the best bet is to make a fall application of the herbicide as well as a spring application. The other option for herbicide-tolerant wheat varieties would be coaxium wheat varieties. And the herbicide we use there is Aggressor. The active ingredient is Quizalofop. So of the two systems, Quizalofop is going to be rated higher for control of cereal rye compared to Beyond.
That was K-State weed specialist Sarah Lancaster. I'm Shelby Varner.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
These are the things I think you should watch out for.
Kevin Brinkley is CEO of Plains Cotton Cooperative Association.
The Federal Reserve, we think they're done. And they might even cut rates. And I think the odds on favor are if they do decide to cut rates, it'll probably be sometime before May of this next year. The reason I say that is they're very hesitant to get involved in the political season. You heard Tom talk about this earlier with the presidential election. They don't want to be seen as swaying that one direction or the other. So watch out for what they're doing. Global uncertainty in the economy, I think, is something that we really have to be mindful of. There's not much we can do about it, but it does help you prepare. A commodity super cycle, should one erupt, and there is a case to be made there, specs and index funds can get in a mighty way. First slide I showed you, $45 billion market for cotton globally. 8 of the top 10 hedge funds have way more money under management than the entire cotton market. So they can push it wherever they want to go. So we have to be mindful of these guys and what they can decide they want to do, good or bad. China, we've talked about them, and of course discretionary spending, and then wars and other conflicts that are erupting out there are certainly going to have momentary impacts, at least on what commodity traders are thinking out there. So we talked about 115 million bales of cotton being used globally. That's an okay number, but we need to do better. I told you that each man, woman, and child averages a little over 6 pounds of cotton consumed on the planet Earth. If we could get everybody using one half pound more of cotton next year, you would drive consumption to 123 million bales. It's about that half pound of cotton would add about 8.4 million bales of cotton to global consumption. We have got to continue to promote our commodity. These are some things that we think are the keys to a competitive future. We've got to be different from Brazil, bottom line. One way we can do that is make our stuff the most sustainable, most traceable cotton on the planet. If you don't know anything about the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol, it's a brand-new program. It's new. It's going to take some time for us to implement it here in the U.S., but I urge you to look into that. It does. It helps move our those bales to the front of the line in terms of customers. We have way more demand for this sustainable cotton than we can supply. And so I urge you to take a look at that. Logistics and handling, we've got to keep investing in that. We've got the best system in the world, regardless of what you've heard from other entities. But we've got to keep improving. Building demand. Your investments in Cotton Incorporated and CCI are paying dividends. If you look at the work that's being done to highlight the dangers of plastic in our environment, it's tremendous work, and I think that's going to help us get that extra half pound, that extra pound of cotton consumed by everybody. Keep getting more efficient in the way that we spend U.S. cotton at textile mills. Push quality as far as you can. And then Tom mentioned this in his presentation. We've got to keep working on strong trade policy to make sure that we're 100% dependent in Texas on exported cotton. We don't use any of this cotton domestically. So we've got to have strong trade policy to make sure we're getting it into the best markets around the world. The way you can do that, work together.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So my path was, I'll start with when I graduated from college. And I grew up in Washington, D.C., and the whole Washington, D.C. political scene is there. But my parents and my family were not part of that. We were just people who lived in Washington. My dad was a lawyer.
Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell.
When I graduated from college, I didn't have a plan. I hadn't thought it through. But I did have one thought, and that was that I wanted to be somebody who had a private sector career, but who also came in and served, did public service from time to time. And I was thinking of people like Cyrus Vance or George Shultz, who had, you know, important private sector careers, but every 8, 10, 12 years, they would come in and serve in the government for a while. That's a unique feature of the U.S. system. You don't really see that that people can have both of those. And oddly enough, that's kind of what happened. So I wound up going to law school. It wasn't that I was dying to be a lawyer, but that was an obvious thing. My dad was a lawyer. I practiced law for just a few years, and then I moved into investment banking because we were working with serving investment bankers, and I could see they were having more fun than we were. So I moved into investment banking, and I really enjoyed that. It was I worked on a lot of mergers. It's a very exciting thing to do. Did that for quite a while. After doing that for a while, I had an opportunity to do public service, and I did move to Washington and serve in the Treasury Department as an assistant and undersecretary under President Bush Sr. Then I moved, so I did that. Then I went back into the financial business and was a partner in a big private equity firm for a while. And now here I am back in public service. So what would you take out of that? One, it is a real... it's such an honor to do public service, and if you have a mainly private sector career, and you want to give back through public service, you can do it in this country. And I think it's important that people in government positions, at least some of them, have had the experience of being in the private sector. At the same time, I think being in the private sector, I think, is informed by also having worked in the public sector. So those are some things. So that's how it all happened. It was pretty unpredictable, but I was willing to change careers and pay the price of having to learn a new field. I had to do that over and over again, but it was worth it.
On his desire to communicate.
You know, I stepped into a role. The Fed does so many things well and right, and the people I succeed are such heroes, really, and so successful and so good at what they did. But when I think of myself in that way, I'm kind of I'm a relatively informal person, and I think of I really do think of getting to good decisions. Part of it is just having a lot of really smart people around you, like President Bostic, like Governor Cook, hearing what they think. And you know, hearing a bunch of different views and a little bit crowdsourcing thinking about issues and then coming to a decision after that's a very comfortable decision. So, but that requires you to really hear what people are saying and understand their arguments. So that comes naturally to me. I also I felt that it was important that we substantially increase our outreach to Congress, which has oversight in our system of government. It's Congress that has oversight over the Fed. And so my colleagues and I spend much more time than we used to going up to the Hill and talking to them and listening to them more. And I think that really pays off. They understand that we're a non-political agency, doesn't use talking points. We're just trying to do our jobs and stick to our jobs. And I think even if they don't agree with what you're doing, and even if it's very difficult times, they know that you're doing your very best and they trust you to do that.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The Department of Agriculture released its quarterly outlook for U.S. agricultural trade. Dave Salmonson, AFBF Senior Government Affairs Director, says the data projects a decrease in exports and an increase of agricultural imports in 2024.
For this year, 2023, agricultural exports have come in at about $179 billion and imports at about $195 billion. So we're seeing an increase in import, a bit of decrease in exports from a year ago when we were about $190 billion. And for next year, that will widen a little bit and we'll be down a little bit more on exports and a further increase in imports. 2023, our agricultural exports to our number one destination, which is China, were right about $34 billion, and their forecast for next year is $29.5 billion. Mexico and Canada will pretty much stay the same. Mexico at $28 billion, Canada at $27 billion. A little bit of decrease in Japan from $12 billion down to $11.5 billion. The European Union, roughly the same, right around the $12 billion mark, and the same with South Korea. The administration needs to get back in the business of working on and executing comprehensive trade agreements. We must continue to enforce aggressively our existing trade agreements. We need to reform the World Trade Organization, especially the dispute settlement function. We need to continue to support and strengthen our agricultural supply chains. And in sustainability, we need the administration to continue to work and support voluntary incentive-based efforts.
Michael Clements, Washington.
K-State wheat production specialist Romulo Lolato discusses what wheat producers should consider if they are planting wheat later than usual. He begins by explaining the planting conditions in Kansas.
We are coming out of 3 years in a row of La Nina, and so very, very dry conditions across those 3 years. Getting into that September planting time with a very limited profile soil moisture. With that, there were scattered rains across the state. We had up to 2 to 4 inches in parts of southwest Kansas. And so for that region, you really kick off planting right there. Then towards the late part of September, there were some rain that came by in northwest and north central Kansas that kind of helped those regions as well. The more central part of the states, it has been a little bit drier, right? Even for planting now, the crop still has a good potential in those regions as long as we get some moisture.
He shares how seeding rate should change when late planting wheat occurs.
whenever we plant wheat at the optimal time, that means that the wheat is going to have enough temperature accumulation in the fall to produce tillers. And those fall tillers, they are the most productive one. What we want to do when we're planting late like this in terms of management adjustments is ramp up seeding rate. That's the main thing that we recommend. We need to compensate for that reduced tillering by simply having more plants out there. And that's pretty clear. I mean, there's a lot of research showing that as we delay planting dates past the optimum, we should be ramping up those populations, right? And so there is a max out there. But again, for every week that we're going late, it is warranted to bump those seeding rates up 10 to perhaps 15 pounds per acre just to compensate for the lack of tillering.
Lotto mentions things producers should be aware of if they are planting wheat late, one of those being how phosphorus can be beneficial for the crop.
Phosphorus as a starter, right, placed in furrow there with the seed, it really, really helps in this situation where we're planting late. And the reason for that is that we're making that phosphorus immediately available to the plant. So, again, if I'm changing at least two things there when I'm planting late, will be ramping up seeding rates, putting out in furrow phos to make sure that we have a good start to the crop. Now, there's a couple other things we can talk about here, too. One of them is we're planting late, we're planting to cooler soils. There's going to be a longer time between planting and emergence, and that can cause some fungal disease, some soil-borne diseases to increase as well. So many times we suggest if you're planting late, that's typically when we see the best benefits from putting a fungicide seed.
That was Kansas State University wheat production specialist Romulo Lulato. I'm Allie Nippert.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One of the things that leads the way for almost every recovery of any kind is crude oil.
Kevin Brinkley is CEO of Plains Cotton Cooperative Association.
It is the underpinning foundation of everything economic. And so when you see prices sort of tail off like we've seen the last couple of weeks, it's good at the gas pump, but that generally means that traders are expecting economic activity to not be as robust as we would like to see it. But overall, you can see an upward trend here as people still have an appetite to use energy, particularly in transportation sectors. And you have to include in that the transportation of goods and services that you order from a store or online. There is an interesting feature to this chart, and that is that, believe it or not, a commodity can trade for a negative price. And you'll see that there in 2020. I don't know how many of you remember that, but the WTI contract went negative by almost $40 a barrel for a few days because there was no place to store it. And so futures prices, oddly enough, can go negative. But overall, this chart is showing you some strength is expected in the global economy.
Talks about the correlation between retail sales and cotton.
Retail sales have continued to be pretty steady for us. You can see the big blips there when COVID hit. They crashed, and then, boy, did the consumer come back in a hurry. Again, $5.5 trillion worth of stimulus money will do a lot for retail sales. But if you look at the more recent trends, you've seen some ups and downs. Particularly, we've seen, I think, stronger than we expected strength in retail apparel. And that, again, is a good sign for us in the cotton industry.
And energy prices and consumers.
Stronger oil prices generally translate to higher gasoline prices. And you can see here, even though we've gotten some relief from a few months ago, we're still in a trend upward on energy prices. And so as you have more vehicles enter the global market, we think that this is probably going to continue to play a role in what households spend their money on. The more money that they spend on gasoline, it's the same at our house, your house. The more money you spend on gasoline, the less you have for other things like a T-shirt or a pair of jeans. So we have to be sure that we're paying attention to what's happening here. Natural gas, you can see a big spike here. This is when Ukraine was invaded by Russia, when prices went sky high there for a while. Our prices are still about five times what they were back in 2020 before COVID hit. You look at the price of natural gas, and we are still really elevated. And this, again, makes it more expensive to heat in homes and run manufacturing facilities.
And then one more outside factor is what Brazil might do with some very dry fields.
They're gonna lean toward beans first, and if you've looked at bean markets, China's been a tremendous buyer of Brazilian soybeans for the past few seasons. But they've got the timing's got to work out pretty well for them, and having a dry bias down there right now, we think that probably a lot of those acres will shift into cotton. But the answer is partially for the future, at least, is how long will Brazil continue to break out more and more acres? Right now, we don't see a stop. To it.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As the demand and supply-related effects of the pandemic continue to unwind, uncertainty about the outlook for the economy is unusually elevated. Like most forecasters, my colleagues and I anticipate that growth in spending and output will slow over the next year as the effects of the pandemic and the reopening fade and as restrictive monetary policy weighs on aggregate demand.
Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell.
The FOMC is strongly committed to bringing inflation down to 2% over time and to keeping policy restrictive until we are confident that inflation is on a path to that objective. It would be premature to conclude with confidence that we have achieved a sufficiently restrictive stance or to speculate on when policy might ease. We are prepared to tighten policy further if it becomes appropriate to do so. So we're making decisions meeting by meeting based on the totality of the incoming data and their implications for the outlook for economic activity and inflation, as well as the balance of risks.